the pressure is mounting against Broward School Superintendent Robert Runcie. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. New information came out this week that conflicts with previous statements the superintendent has made about the shooter Nicholas Cruz. We'll talk with the father of one of the shooting victims, who's also a member of the new commission put together by the governor to make schools safer. Plus, Angela Pozzi is an artist who creates large replicas of sea life, fish and seals, and even giant jellyfish. And she makes them entirely out of the trash she collects from the ocean.
That's what Washed Ashore does, is we make things beautiful and horrifying at the same time.
And the Moth Story Slam is a popular event that allows ordinary folks the opportunity to tell a personal story to strangers. The event is taking a twist by going all Spanish. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. There are new revelations that Nicholas Cruz, the man accused of killing 17 people at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, was ordered to go through the controversial disciplinary program known as PROMISE. It allows some students who have committed misdemeanors the opportunity of not having to go through the criminal justice system. Now, this comes after the fact that Superintendent Robert Runcie and the Broward Sheriff's Office originally denied his involvement. And all of this comes on the heels of the MSD Public Safety Commission's first meeting to begin the process of trying to figure out how to make schools safer. Now, one of the members of that commission is a father who lost a daughter in the shooting back in February, Elena Petty. He joins us now via Skype, Ryan Petty. Mr. Petty, thank you so much for joining us today.
Good afternoon, Luis. Thanks for having me.
You know, I wanted to start with really the latest story, obviously, and that's this week. You know, WLRN reported that Nicholas Cruz, the person charged with the death of these people at the high school, was part of the district's PROMISE program. What was your reaction when you first heard that news?
Well, I personally was stunned. The previous communications from the district had all been very clear that Mr. Cruz had not participated in the PROMISE program, so stunned to learn that, in fact, he had been.
Now, you attended the community forum last night, and Superintendent Robert Runcie was there, and he pushed back against criticism about this news, that he was incorrect in Cruz's involvement in the program. Did you get to talk to the superintendent at all?
I did not speak with Superintendent Runcie last night. I did not have an opportunity to do that.
What questions do you have right now for him?
My focus is really around trying to make sure our children and our teachers and staff are safe in school. So my questions would all be directed toward that end. How do we ensure the safety and security of our, you know, most valued and treasured kids and students. And I want to make sure the kids and students in the Broward schools are safe. So my questions would all be around that topic.
Did the forum last night address any of those concerns?
I don't think it did. In fact, the purpose of the forum was, I think, to help the community better understand the PROMISE program. But I don't think it addressed any of the school safety or security issues that I think are on the minds of most of the parents and certainly teachers and administrators in our public schools.
And in trying to make schools safer, and that's part of what the commission is about, and I want to talk about that in just a moment, you're going to have to work with the superintendent and with the sheriff's department. Is your approach in dealing with them going to change in any way? I mean, is there any scrutiny here that you have on again, learning what you just did this week, what we've all learned about, Mr. Cruz's involvement in this program? Does anything change in the way you deal with the school board and with the sheriff's department moving forward?
Well, I think the issue is that there are confusing and conflicting, I think, school discipline policies in Broward County schools. The issue is not any one program, and specifically, the issue is not the PROMISE program. In fact, I think the objectives of the PROMISE program are quite are quite good. I think students should be given an opportunity and a second chance. I don't think that's at issue here. I think what's at issue is the implementation and execution of these programs across the district. I think there's confusion and a misunderstanding of how these discipline policies are supposed to be implemented by school administrators, by teachers, and that uncertainty is creating chaotic situations in our classrooms, and it's creating an unsafe environment for our students and our teachers. Not to mention a challenge in actually educating the students in the classroom.
Is there any concern about honesty? Are you worried about any about the superintendent and the sheriff being honest with us?
I believe our elected officials need to be transparent and open, and I would hope that the school district would be open and transparent as we try to dig into what happened at Marjory Stoneman Douglas, and we try to understand the other school safety issues that are impacting schools across the district. We need to understand what happened. We need to shine a light there so that we can prevent it from happening again.
Now, you said that for the most part, if I heard you correctly, that this the Promise program, you support it. You think that it has value?
I think a program that gives students a second chance, I think we ought to be doing that. I don't have an issue with that. Specifically, the concern I have again is how does that program interrelate with the other discipline policies and programs within the district, and the confusion that having multiple discipline programs creates.
Let's talk about this commission. Again, it is the Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School Public Safety Commission, put together by the governor, this, of course, after the shooting, and you are one of the members of this commission. Help us understand, what is the goal for this commission? What is your purpose and your mission?
Well, the commission was created by Senate Bill 7026 that was passed. Look, our goal and mission is to investigate the failures that led up to the tragic events that took the life of my daughter and 16 others, and injured 17 others at Marjory Stoneman Douglas. We're to learn about what happened. We're to learn about the events leading up to that, and we're to try to understand it in a way that we can make recommendations about how to prevent anything like that from happening in the future.
And you had your first meeting not too long ago. How would you describe how that meeting went?
Well, I left hopeful that we're going to be able to uncover the facts that are necessary to make those recommendations in the future. I thought the first meeting was enlightening. We got to hear testimony from Broward Sheriff's Office and about the event. We got to, which was personally very painful for me, to watch an animation of the shooting. Quite difficult for those of us. I think it was quite difficult for all the commissioners, but certainly difficult for the three parents that are a part of that commission to have to watch that. But if we can protect other children in our schools, then the difficulty and pain of having to watch animation and learn about what happened that day, and quite frankly, the things that we could have done differently to prevent that from happening, will be well worth it.
Yeah, you're talking about that presentation they had, and they basically walked everyone through the events of that day, and it was a layout of the school, of that particular building where the shooting took place. The people involved, the students, teachers, the shooter, were represented by dots. And you think about it, it seemed like such a benign way to describe it, and yet watching it, and I've seen it, as the shooter moves through the building, you know, the dots change color depending on whether they're injured or killed. I mean, you're watching this and you're hearing, and again, the speaker, you know, without emotion, just basically describing what's happening in a very cold manner. I mean, what are you thinking about at that point?
It was painful to watch. Because I saw the dot that represented my daughter, Elena. And I had to watch it change color. And then I watched as 16 other dots changed color. And I thought about the kids in that building and the fear that they must have been feeling as they realized what was happening. And many on the third floor attempting to flee to safety from the hallway, which was not a good place for them to be. So it was quite quite emotional, quite painful to watch. But as I said, if we can take what the lessons that we learned from what happened at Marjory Stoneman Douglas and keep the other kids in Broward County schools, and quite frankly, make recommendations that can be applied across the state of Florida and hopefully best practices that will help schools across the country, then that personal pain that the fathers on the commission are having to endure will be worth it.
The commission has to come up with a report by January of 2019. I mean, again, we just started these meetings, but I want to know from you, what do you think we should be doing to make schools safer? If you could do anything, what would it be?
Well, I think we have to get to these disaffected and troubled kids early. You know, an ounce of prevention's worth a pound of cure, as they say. And I'd like to, you know, as I've studied this, I've learned from the Secret Service, who's been studying this since Columbine, that many of these kids signal their intentions before they actually commit these atrocities. And in fact, 80% of them. And Cruz was no different. He made several public statements on social media about his intentions. And so my thoughts have turned to, how can we capture that information? How can we identify these shooters before they commit these atrocities? And what can we do to prevent that from them from acting? And I think you know, one of the lessons that I think we'll clearly learn in this commission is there were several opportunities to intervene in Mr. Cruz's life, starting back in middle school and certainly through his high school career. Opportunities to intervene, either through disciplinary action or in certain cases, I would imagine there were actual criminal infractions that, had they been taken seriously and had they been dealt with the way that they should have been dealt with, Mr. Cruz would have had a criminal record, and that criminal record would have showed up in a background check, and he would not have been able to purchase firearms. So this was, unfortunately, it appears already quite preventable. And the Broward County schools and law enforcement were not collaborating in a way that I believe they should have been, in a way that would have allowed them to identify this risk and properly the risk that Mr. Cruz posed and to properly deal with it.
What do you think about everything that's happened since, when you look at the students, their activism? They've been not just in Tallahassee, they've been all over the country. They've started a movement that tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people have followed. What do you think about what they're doing? And do you think it's actually accomplishing anything? Are we going to get any closer to making school safer?
I think we will. And I think the students have brought a ton of energy and have kept the interest of the public. They've done an amazing job of doing that. So, and they've done it in ways that, you know, many adults and parents would struggle to do. They've gone to social media, and they're social media natives, so they understand the way to use social media to amplify their messages. And I think, you know, as a father that lost a daughter, I appreciate the activism. I appreciate the ability that they've had to keep the focus on what happened in Parkland, because we all know how these news cycles work. We all know that there's a there's an initial focus and attention given to these, you know, mass shootings, these school shootings, and then ultimately that interest wanes, and the national media, for example, goes on to other things. And so the students have been incredibly helpful in keeping the focus and the attention. They've been helpful in applying pressure to public officials and politicians that that we need to make changes. And and then as a group of families, I gotta say, I'm you know, I said before, this is not a club that any parent wants to be in, but if I had to pick 17 families to be in a club with, these are an amazing group of families, and we have come together, we have bonded together, we talk every day as a group of families, and we have accomplished, I'm proud of what we've accomplished in a very short period of time. Three, you know, the legislation in Florida, and then of course the bills in the U.S. Congress, the two bills that we were able to pass have made a difference. Red flag laws, for example, in Florida have been used. I understood, this, my information is a little bit old. It's been about a week, something like 130 times already since the law has been passed. So we have accomplished a lot, as a group of families, and, I couldn't be, more proud of the efforts and the reaction and response that the families have had to this tragedy.
What when's the next meeting for the commission?
The date hasn't been set, but I understand we're trying to do something in May, but it may, and hopefully we'll be able to reconvene in May.
And do you have any idea what might be discussed or what's the next step?
I haven't seen an agenda yet for the next meeting, but certainly we're going to want to dig into the school district policies and in light of the news that that broke over the weekend, I think we're going to want to dig into the discipline policies and their impacts, the discipline policy, I should say, of the Broward County School District.
Mr. Petty, I'm so sorry for your loss, but I do appreciate the work that you're doing. I appreciate your time today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Elise.
And again, that's Ryan Petty. He lost his daughter in the Marjory Stoneman Douglas shooting, Elena Petty. And he is also part, as I said, of the Marjory Stoneman Douglas Public Safety Commission. This is a commission put together by the governor, and they are working on a program they're working on a report they got to put together by January of next year in trying to find a way to make our schools safer. Now, the news that he was talking about, again, was the news that WLRN reported on Monday, that the new revelations that Nicholas Cruz, again, the man accused of shooting 17 people at the school, was ordered to go through the controversial disciplinary program known as PROMISE. And that is a program in Broward County that allows some students who have committed misdemeanors the opportunity of avoiding the criminal justice system. They have to go through a program to get help. We remembered that Superintendent Runcie and even the Broward Sheriff's Office before had said that Nicholas Cruz had not gone through that program. Now we find out that he was ordered to go through that program. We're going to follow that story again as more information comes out. So stay tuned to WLRN as we get more of that information. Taking a deep breath, we're going to switch things up a little bit. Still to come, Miami's Moth Story Slam is changing things up a bit. Va completamente al español. More on Sundown coming up next here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, what are the key connections in your life and who are you connecting with? A community-wide initiative across Miami-Dade County called 10 Days of Connections tackles those questions in a number of ways. There's a series of events happening until Thursday that include communal dinners, town halls, dances, and a lot more. Well, tonight, the Miami Moth Story Slam is getting involved with its own storytelling event focused on, yeah, of course, connections. This program is held once a month, and the stories are recorded and curated for the Moth Radio Show, which you may have heard on NPR. This month's program is unique, as all of the stories will be told in Spanish. It will be the first time a Story Slam has been done entirely in Spanish. The host of the Miami Moth Story Slam, Gabby Fernandez, came to our studios and explained how the program works.
You show up, and if you want to tell a story, you sign up. And throughout the night, we randomly pick 10 storytellers to share their stories.
Wait, you pick randomly. What does that mean? You throw names out of a hat, or you just poke into the audience? You.
Technically out of a tote bag. But yes, you sign up, and we put the paper with your name inside of a tote bag, and we randomly pick it like a raffle.
All right. How long have you been hosting the Moth Story Slams here in Miami?
I've been hosting for, I want to say, almost 3 years. I know they started in Miami in 2015, and I must have started with them around 2016, end of 2015.
You know, what's interesting about the Moth is that it's known for really having these powerful, intimate storytelling moments. From your recollection and experience, what kind of stories have you heard in these events that either shook you, made you laugh, or just like blew your mind?
That's a great question, because most people come to the Story Slam thinking they have to make people laugh. And it's not a comedy show. We're here to share stories. So one of the things I like to remind people is that we want to connect with you as a person. So I love stories of people being bad. Like, usually when you tell a story or an anecdote about yourself, you're the good guy. You're the one that's right, you know? So I love it when people tell stories about a time that they manipulated, or a time that they lied, or a time that they did what was wrong.
You want confessions.
Yes.
All right.
Confessions, admissions, and discoveries.
Do you remember one that jumped out at you?
Oh, man. There's been several. There's been a couple about cheating on your partner.
Right.
That are always very, very interesting. I think it's the telenovela inside of me that loves those stories. There's been a couple about lying at work, too. Those are great.
So when you hear these, though, I mean, look, you a lot of times you're going to get somebody who they don't know how to present. Mm-hmm. They don't spend a lot of time on a stage. They're not a pro like you. Now they're going to come up and they're going to start sharing. Do you find that people just automatically open up and start telling their story, or do they have to kind of work their way into it? Do you have to push them and pull them into it?
Sometimes you have to push a little bit. Usually the first couple of storytellers will be a little bit more tame. And as the night progresses, like storytellers 6 through 10 will be a lot more loose. We also have a bar on site.
Do you find that as the night goes on, people have had a few drinks, that kind of
loosens
lips? Oh, yeah.
Courage helps, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So, you know, I'd also imagine, too, that every now and then you get that one story that is powerful or funny or interesting. But then you get people who are just not good at telling stories. Storytelling is difficult.
It is. It's an art. It's an art. It's very hard for people to understand that a story has a beginning, a middle, and an end. It's which sounds kind of logical to people that are used to writing, but regular people that share a story get really nervous. B, you're there with your friends or with a date and you want to show off and you want to look good. And then something happens the minute that you get on the stage and the light is blinding you, that you completely forget everything that you had rehearsed in your head.
And so when that happens, you've seen that happen.
Yes.
So then what happens at that point? I mean, do you try to help them, or do you just stay off the stage?
Oh, no. We're very encouraging at the Moth. We give them a big round of applause. We help them out. I'll whisper in their ear like, you're okay. You're doing great. Come on. Just start the story. I'll pat them on the shoulder. But yeah, usually people, once they get that round of applause, once they get like a couple of seconds to just breathe and center themselves, take a last shot, you know, they'll get started.
All right. But I'd also imagine you probably see people who just, they get through it somehow, and everybody is probably like, all right, good. That's over.
Yeah.
Hey, what about when you have nights where a lot of people are really just, they're blowing it?
That hardly ever happens. I mean, some nights are better than others content wise, I guess, but you always have that one story. You always have that one person that sometimes, even if the story is not great, but the delivery, like the person was so passionate about it, or the person was such a quirky character, or they have a really weird way of speaking or something, that it just captivates you. So there's always diamond.
So when do you know that you've had that moment?
Quiet. When the room is quiet. When you don't hear anybody talking or you don't hear anybody breathing, you know it. It's, yeah.
Again, I'm talking with Gabby Fernandez. She hosts the monthly storytelling event, which is known as the Moth Story Slam. And again, as we've heard, they pick people randomly to come up and share a story, any kind of story, as long as it goes with a theme. And by the way, it is being performed Tuesday, May 8th at the Olympia Theater Lobby Lounge starting at 7 o'clock. There's something very unique about this one this time. We're going to get to that in a minute. The theme for this one this month is connections.
Yes.
How are they picked?
The Moth headquarters in New York gives us the themes, so they pick it.
Do people tend to stick to the themes, or do they just, again, go off the rails?
50-50. We always explain the theme at the beginning of the night, and a lot of times people will do little cheats. Like, for example, if the theme is connections, you know, we're talking about human connections or connecting with long-lost friends or lovers, and then people will be like, yeah, I bought an iPhone and I had to get a connector for it. Connections. And you're like, no, that is not the theme.
I right now I wish it had a sound that I can just go, wah, wah. Okay, so anyway, this first, this is the first, I should say, Story Slam all in Spanish.
Sí, señor.
Why did they pick Miami for the first ever Spanish one?
I mean, you can't think about Miami and not think about Spanish, I feel. Miami is one of the most culturally diverse cities in this country, in my opinion. We have a little bit of everything. And in America, Spanish is language number two. I mean, everywhere you go nowadays, you hear Spanish. So it was a very natural fit to try to do a story slam in Spanish.
Up to this point, though, tell me about your audiences. Tell me about the people who are coming to the story slam, because it almost seems like you're trying to reach a different type of audience with this now.
You'd be surprised. First of all, we have a very mixed demographic. It's kind of crazy to see people of so many ages and so many different backgrounds in the lobby of the Olympia Theater once a month. And we have a lot of bilingual followers. So we have a lot of people that will be telling their story in English, and it happens to me a lot. And then they'll do like a weird pause, and then they're like, pero entonces, okay, back to English, you know? So I think there's a need for Spanish storytelling.
You get a lot of Spanglish?
Sometimes we do, actually. Mostly from me.
What are you expecting, though? Do you, I mean, with just Spanish speakers coming up and telling their story, do you expect anything different?
Well, I expect different kinds of stories. I hope for more stories about immigration. I hope for more stories about overcoming obstacles, more stories about coming to live here and experiencing new things from a different cultural perspective.
Do you have a story that you would love to share?
Yeah, actually. I remember when I first came to live here, I landed in Naples, Florida, actually, and it was my first day in high school, and I was very lost. Even though I did speak a little bit of English, it was just very weird because when I got to the high school cafeteria, it was like I was in a movie because there was the nerds table, the jock table, the Latino table, and I was standing in the middle like, oh my God, this is American Pie. Like, I can't believe I'm actually living this. Like, this can't be. And I must have looked like an alien because this girl walked up to me and she was like, are you okay? And I was like, I don't know where to sit. Like, I don't know which one's my category. And she's like, where are you from? I'm like, I'm from Venezuela. She's like, I'm Colombian. Here, you should sit with us at the Latino table. So I was like, okay, I guess that's my stereotype. I'm in the Latino table. And she actually like took me under her wing and like guided me through the whole American high school process and took me to my homeroom and introduced me to all the friends. And till this day, she's one of my dearest friends. And we recently reconnected on Facebook and it's been amazing.
Good story. All right. I didn't, growing up in the 80s, I mean, they had the nerd jock table and it, yeah, but I didn't have the Latino table. There was no such thing for me at the time. Coming back to this question of, coming back to the fact that, again, this is going to be the first one ever in Spanish. Mm-hmm. Does anything change in the way you've set this up, in the way that this Moth Storytelling Slam is going to be told in Spanish, or is everything still the same procedure? It's still the same. People come in, you're going to pick your 10. Everybody gets their time.
Yes, it's exactly the same. The only difference is that it's in Spanish. But same rules, 10 storytellers, 3 three groups of judges, a winner at the end of the night, during the intermission.
You ever been a judge?
No.
How are these judged?
These are judged much like the judicial system by your peers. So the producer, Virginia, she randomly picks groups of people who want to judge that night and gives them a set of rules and some scorecards. So throughout the night, after every story, I get the scores from all the judges. And they have to pick funny names for themselves, like pun names.
For themselves as they go up and tell their story.
As a group of judges.
Oh, as a group of judges. I see. I gotcha.
Mm-hmm.
Do you expect, because you're now going to get stories in Spanish, that maybe the way the stories are told are a little bit different? By that I mean, I think about when I go see a show in English and in Spanish, and I think about how the audience behaves. Even if I go to a sporting event or I go to any kind of event, there is a difference in how I see Latinos or Spanish speakers behaving compared to non-Spanish speakers. But do you expect anything different in how this is going to go?
I guess I do expect a more bold audience in a way. I think we'll have a lot of side commentary that we usually don't have. Probably a louder audience, a more boisterous audience. But really, at the end of the day, the Moth is not an event where you like go crazy like in a sporting event and start cheering. So I really don't know. I don't know how they'll expect. Maybe more salsa during the intermission.
There you go. Perfect. And again, that was Gabby Fernandez, host of the Moth Miami Story Slam. You can find more details about the show at the Olympia Theater tonight or other events that are part of the 10 Days of Connections by visiting our website, WLRN.org. All right, still to come, we talk to a Sea Life artist whose materials for her work are made entirely of trash from the sea. That's all coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, I want to tell you about Priscilla the Fish. She's a 1,600-pound sculpture at the Mounts Botanical Garden in West Palm Beach. She's an impressive work of art with shimmering turquoise fins and bright orange eyes. And she's made entirely from trash found on the beach. Priscilla is one of 10 massive ocean life sculptures on display at Mounts. They are the artistic creations of Angela Hazeltine Potsey. The Oregon-based artist and environmentalist started Washed Ashore, a nonprofit dedicated to creating art that cleans the sea and inspires change. Potsey joined us from the studios of WBEZ in Chicago. We started the conversation by discussing her first encounter with ocean trash.
I was walking down from a cliff into my favorite area in southern Oregon on the coast there. And I just moved to the area and spending most of my days walking the beaches to try to find meaning in life. And I looked down on my favorite beach, and there was this mosaic, jiggity-jaggity line going all the way as far as the eye could see, and it was plastics. And at the same time, I saw a group of people, which is very common along the Oregon coast, of people with buckets picking up agates and shells right on the shoreline, right next to the water. And I realized that those people didn't even see all this plastic. They had just walked right by it. And I remember at that moment, I said to myself, how am I going to get those people to pick up that stuff?
You know, much of the media coverage we see surrounding massive piles of trash in the ocean, they are horrifying. They're like dystopian images, right?
Yeah, and it's really everywhere now. There's so much more research now than there was 8 years ago when I started Washed Ashore. It's really in the entire water column, and about 70% of the garbage in the ocean is already on the bottom and really hard to access. So it's really, it's a horrible situation. And there is a lot more awareness about the plastic pollution issue now and than there was before. So, you know, I have hope. I have hope. But it is a sad situation. We all need to be aware of what's going on.
Take us through how you approach this artistic endeavor.
I I was a very fortunate person, and I think I realized this early on, that I was raised by my mother, who was a professional artist, and my father, who ran an art center and was an arts administrator. So the arts were always my first language, and I always had great respect for the arts as a as an amazing language and tool and communication tool, really. And so I had become an art teacher for 30 years, and I always believed in the power of the arts and as part of life. And, you know, art for life's sake as opposed to art for art's sake is what I've always taught. And I had done a lot of my own personal work and exhibited in galleries successfully. And that work was primarily found objects and things from thrift stores turned into coral reefs. And things about the ocean was always what I was doing because I love the ocean so much and it was always a part of my life. But what really kind of got me into this current work with Washed Ashore Art to Save the Sea is I lost my husband to a brain tumor after 25 years of marriage, and I was left a widow at age 47 and pretty much felt like, you know, the rug was pulled out from underneath me. And I decided to move to the ocean to try to figure out how to heal from all that. And like, what am I supposed to do with my life now? You know, he was an artist and a teacher, so we were really close. And I was just like, how could this happen? What am I supposed to do now? And so I was basically walking the beaches to try to find my purpose in life. And that's where I found it. You know, I basically came to the ocean to heal, but I found an ocean that needed healing. And I thought, I need to never buy another piece of art supply, and I need to only use what's on the beach, and I need to get everybody to work with me, and we've got to save the ocean. And so that's how it started.
You know, it's interesting. You go back to what you were doing before and how you ended up now working with this kind of material. Do you believe people are motivated by relatable art or art that scares them?
Ooh, that's a really great question. I think both. You know, the reason I do giant animals made with the garbage that we pick up is that I wanted to show it to people and make it real to them. And I also wanted to make them want to see it, because what I saw on that day on that beach was that people didn't want to see it. And I thought, how am I going to make people want to see this stuff? And then lure them in to get their picture taken next to it, or, you know, to go talk to their neighbor about it. And I thought, well, a giant animal of the ones that are being threatened by the plastic pollution is the perfect messaging. And being a teacher of kids for so long, I also realized that our younger generation is how we're going to help solve this, you know, all these problems. We've got to pull the kids in. And so, my other thing was I wanted to reach everybody. And, you know, I'd been to a lot of museums and everything where your audience is very narrow. And, you know, you only get the people that go to art museums or just, you know, pay the money to go through the doors. But if you want to reach Joe and Betty down the street who've never been to a museum and maybe litter on the beach but don't think about it and, you know, figure it's not their problem, I want to reach them. And I thought, I've got to make something that makes them want to look at it and stop and think. And so that's what Washed Ashore does, is we make things beautiful and horrifying at the same time. We make things, I mean, I purposely, because I'm the sculptor, I actually do the finish work and the heads and the eyes and the tails and the feet and stuff like that. And I make it so that you see things that you recognize. So there are things, when you walk up to it, you see lighters, you see toothbrushes, you see, you know, bottle caps, you see water bottles, you see stuff that you use in your everyday life. And therefore, you take ownership and you start asking, what's going on here? And then we use signage and other things to teach.
You mentioned your husband's death. Did he have a passion for the ocean like you, or did that come after?
Yeah, he was a lieutenant in the Navy, actually, back in the days. And so he always loved the ocean. We had moved to the ocean and then moved back to Portland, Portland, Oregon, where we had better jobs. But, yeah, no, he loved the ocean as well, but I had really grown up with it. Every summer of my childhood would been spent, you know, poking at animals and tide pools and studying nudibranchs, which are little sea slugs and weird stuff. And I also grew up on Puget Sound. So I just, that was my world that I really loved to escape to. And, but yeah.
You know, and you also mentioned you were an arts educator. Did you engage students in conversations about environmental stewardship?
Well, let's see. I helped start two arts magnet schools where you actually integrate all of art, science, math, reading, language arts all together. So in that regard, I worked with a lot of environmental, ecology teachers, science teachers, and I would engage them in the beauty of nature and things like that. But I hadn't really reached that that point. Because I was teaching elementary and junior high and some high school students as well. At the high school level, I could really get into that whole social commentary use of the arts and the powerful language that they can be and sort of the edgy stuff. But really had not tapped into it like this project does.
You know what? I've read that as an arts teacher, you often worked with little or no supplies. So,
yes. It's okay. Great training for what I'm doing now.
yeah, I could see that now. I mean, having taken art classes, I'm wondering, wait a minute, how did she do that? But okay. Yeah. How did that help you craft this trash into something so beautiful?
Well, it's pretty funny because, you know, I've been thinking about how I got to this point for so long. You know, how did I get here? And I realized there's so many things that added up. But you're right. As an art teacher, you never have a budget. So you're always scrounging for materials and you're always looking for anything free. And I used to go to printing companies and get all their stuff that was heading into the recycler or the garbage and use their papers and their, you know, die cut forms and all kinds of interesting things that were going to get thrown out and figure out what to do with them. So, yeah, I've always done that. And then, but as a kid, my mother, Maury Hazeltine, she did drawing and painting primarily, but she also did a whole series of collages. And when I was like 7 years old, my mother used to take me to the dump. And she would go there and look for interesting art supplies and, you know, interesting things to put in her collages because she would put like banged up metal and all kinds of really crazy things. And so, I mean, I guess I was trained early on, you know, about that.
Interesting place to take your kid, but I could see how it's paid off pretty nicely. Again, I'm talking with Angela Hazeltine Potsey, artistic director behind Washed Ashore. It's a multi-city exhibition of large sculptures of the ocean's creatures made entirely from trash that's washed up on beaches. 10 giant sea life sculptures are on display at the Mounts Botanical Garden in West Palm Beach. Angela, how do you want your art to inspire change in consumer behavior?
Well, that's really the ultimate goal of our nonprofit, washedashore.org, is really to spark positive changes in consumer habits. And there's so many different ways to do that. We are hoping that by people seeing how much is out there and how much has been just picked up off of a small area of beaches, which could be anywhere in the world, that it'll make people think about their own plastic usage and ask the question, what can I do to change this? How can I reduce my plastic usage? What can I do next? And we're an interesting organization because we're non-political. We're here to wake up people and have them take the next step. So, you know, sometimes we wake up people who then, you know, go in and talk to their own city council about changing their city laws, or they walk in and say, I just saw this exhibit and we need to stop carrying water bottles in our school district, or we need to stop handing them out at our convention, or we need to, you know. So we're hoping that we work on that on our signage. So each work of art also has something you can do right now to reduce your plastic footprint. And so we give people tangible ways of doing that. You know, even if it's not using a plastic bag anymore and making your new habits to bring a a reusable bag or reusable water bottles. Or those two are the easiest you can do. But then there's, you know, takeout containers. You know, I always tell people just ask for foil for your food when you go to get it, something takeout. Just ask for foil because that's recyclable. And then you're reducing that waste right there.
Did you ever envision that the scope of this artistic project would reach this magnitude?
Well, I actually have been doing that from the beginning. That was my goal. I mean, hey, I was, you know, looking for a reason to live, and I thought I need to save the ocean, and the ocean touches every continent in the world, so had to be a global project. And so that's always been my goal. And last year, we were fortunate to actually be invited by the United Nations to exhibit our work at the Ocean Conference, the first UN Ocean Conference. And we got to talk to world leaders right there. And we now have invitations around the world to come and bring our exhibit or to work with them to create their own exhibit or, you know, various things. So we're trying to figure out how to do that next.
You work with volunteers to collect trash in, and that's in Bandon, right?
Yeah, it's Bandon, Oregon. It's just a little tiny town, about 3,500 people. And we've worked with over 10,000 volunteers in the last 8 years. They help us build our sculptures as well as pick up garbage. So the thing that's really unique about Washed Ashore is that although I'm the lead artist and the designer of the project, all the small parts of the gigantic sculptures are made with volunteer help. And that way we engage people in the discussion more, and we can bring kids in to help be part of the communication. And that's something I love about Washed Ashore, is that these giant sculptures really take hundreds of people working together to make these big things happen. And that's really how we're going to solve the world's problems, is everyone working together to make something bigger happen. And so we kind of make a tangible reminder of that.
You go back to the beginning of this project, and what was the initial reaction like?
It was overwhelming. I was, it was really exciting. People got it, and people were like, wow, I had no idea there was this much garbage in the ocean, and this is a great wake-up call, and now I can see it, and now my kids, I can talk to my kids about it, and they understand what I'm talking about. And, you know, now everyone has a way of discussing it. And, you know, it was really has, and I think that as an artist, it's pretty amazing to be part of a project that keeps getting that kind of response over and over again, because it's really powerful when people see the real thing. You know, it's not numbers and it's not talk. It's the real thing. This is the real garbage that's out there.
I know that cleaning this up and being a part of protecting the ocean is going to probably be with you the rest of your life. But this project, this art project, is this a lifelong project?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Definitely. You know, as I'm now 60, so I'm proud to say that. I'm still running a drill up on a 14-foot ladder. But there might be a time when I want to scale back. But, you know, I have an amazing staff. It's an exciting time for us. I see it. I'll always be involved in it and, you know, keep going, take care of the body so it can keep running a drill on a 14-foot ladder and, you know, make eyes out of garbage. But I'll do my best.
Again, that was Angela Hazeltine, the executive director of Washed Ashore. The exhibit at the Mounts Botanical Garden is going on until June 3rd. You can find more information about the exhibit and a picture of Priscilla the fish by visiting our website, WLRN.org. I would entice you just to go to her website as well and check out some of the beautiful images of the artwork she's created. And again, all of it made out of trash she has found from the ocean. Well, that's the program for today. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for listening. We'll talk to you tomorrow.